At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to be looking at what's happened since the first lab-grown burger and why aren't we all eating them today. We'll also be speaking about what happens to your data when you die. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter, we're at @NewstalkScience. Now, before we get into news, just a reminder that I am very interested in using AI. I've been doing it for quite some time now, and I've had these conversations with people, and they are unimpressed, or they're getting bad results. And I realize that a lot of people aren't using it correctly. They don't know how to interact with LLMs, these large language models that really have so much to give us right now. So I set up a workshop. It's going to be touring the country. We're starting off in Dublin at an event on the 26th of September in Dunleary, the 30th of September in Ballsbridge. These are 2-hour super practical workshops. Bring your laptop. You're going to learn so much about how to get stuff done fast, not just marketing things, but looking at sales, setting up a chatbot, having a digital assistant, being able to ask a PDF, any question you want. So many things that you go, I know exactly how I'm going to use that in my day-to-day life. If you would like to know more, tickets and information at getstartedai.com. I think it's going to be amazing. I hope you'll join me. All right, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining us is Dr. Susan Kelleher from DCU's School of Chemical Sciences. Yes,
that's
she's
correct.
Nodding along. Good. And also Dr. Jessamine Fairfield from the University of Galway. You're both very welcome. Our first story has to do with sleep apnea. Susan.
Yes. So this is my story. And it's exactly the kind of science story that I really like, where a drug that was intended and designed to do one thing ends up being super effective at doing something else. So it's that sort of exploratory science that you're sort of discouraged at doing, but also we should really be doing more of. So, for example, the first antiviral drug approved to treat AIDS in 1987 was actually a failed cancer drug, which, again, amazing that that's come through. And then the blockbuster drug Ozempic that we all know about, that was originally developed to actually treat type 2 diabetes. And now it's one of the most prescribed drugs in the world, and they can't seem to make enough of it. It's used to suppress appetites to help with weight loss.
And Viagra, of course. Viagra.
Yeah, and Viagra, of course, which was made in Ireland. It was usually originally used for heart medication, right? So reducing blood pressure. So,
what happened was they found out about it because people weren't giving the unused tablets back. There were no unused tablets for men. And they were like, why are we not getting these tablets back? And then they went, wait a second. Boners was the answer.
It's just incredible because when you think of all the molecules that are created in any one year, you know, and all the new development, and everything's always the new and the best and the next and the brightest, there's loads of things out there that actually could possibly really be really useful. And this is a story that was written in The Guardian recently that reports on results that were presented. So it's not published yet, but it's presented at the European Respiratory Society Congress in Vienna recently. And it outlines potential use that an epilepsy drug might have in treating sleep apnea. So sleep apnea affects about 1 in 20 people, which is huge. And the symptoms include difficulty while breathing, breathing while sleeping, sufferers, they snore loudly, their breathing is interrupted during their sleep. And they often wake up at nighttime, which has other consequences. It is basically shown to have an effect on increasing the risk of high blood pressure, stroke, and heart disease. So we don't want that. So it's a very difficult thing to treat at the moment. It's treated mechanically, basically, with sort of a large mask that you wear over your face. But this research showed that there was basically researchers involved carried out a clinical trial on almost around 300 people across Europe. And they gave 3/4 of them the epilepsy drug at different strengths, and then a quarter of them had a placebo effect, a placebo rather. And they studied the patient's breathing, oxygen, heart rhythm, their eye movement, and their brain and their muscle activity while they slept. And after a course of 12 weeks, those that had taken the drug had up to 50% fewer times where their breathing stopped, and they had higher levels of oxygen in their blood during sleep. So it was really a very powerful effect, an unexpected effect. So the authors on this, or the people who commented on this, who were involved in the research, say that it's probably not that far away that a drug is out there, or that can be used to treat sleep apnea. And largely because these drugs are approved, right? That's the best thing about them.
These
have been approved at different levels across different countries. And so getting them to market would be a lot easier, because we know that they may have limited side effects, you know, or at least they're going to be less dangerous maybe than something that has yet to be tested.
There are lots of things about sleep apnea, like, you know, it's really bad for your health. For some people, it's like, you know, that time when you just fall asleep and you go, oh, and you wake up again, like that happening all the way through now, which is awful. But also you got this elephant mask on your face at bedtime. It makes it very difficult to sleep. You know, you've got a partner next to you that's also, you know, like, it's just tricky. And so this would be great if we could find an intervention that would help those people. Our second story, Jessamine, has to do with gene therapies. And this is a potentially very exciting story.
Yeah, this is an amazing new application of gene therapy to treat a disease of the eye, where the treatment actually led to, on average, a 100 times improvement in people's sight over this small trial, which is really amazing. So this is research done out of the University of Pennsylvania, which is actually my alma mater. The trial was done on 15 people who had this rare inherited disease.
Alma mater, that means where you went to college.
Yeah. Yes, it's where I went to grad school. Yeah. Okay. They actually have the one of the worst mascots in the world, I think, which is the Fighting Quaker.
The what?
Quakers, famous for their fighting, famous pacifists.
Like Quaker, like the religion? Like, is it like,
yeah,
a little,
like the
a leprechaun, but it's a Quaker? Like a, like,
yep,
the Notre Dame?
The big hat and everything. The Fighting Quaker. Makes no sense. So yeah, the great people at the University of Pennsylvania have done this study, and they looked at 15 people, so a relatively small trial of people who had this disease called labor congenital amaurosis. And this is basically damage to a gene that makes these proteins on the retina at the back of the eye, which you really need to be able to see. So it causes sight loss, like, from infancy. It affects less than 100,000 people worldwide, but it's actually one of the leading causes of infant blindness, because it comes in right away. Like, you just can't make those proteins at the back of the eye. And gene therapy is a really great approach to this kind of illness, because it involves changing gene expression at a very localized level. So you're trying to say, okay, this one gene that isn't quite working correctly, let's swap in something that will allow it to work properly using either like a viral mechanism, or to take these new DNA pieces into the cell, or like bacterial approaches, which is how CRISPR works. So these people, you know, there were some children involved in the study, as well as older people who had had many decades of sight loss. They started out with a really low dose of the gene therapy to see, like, was it safe? Was it, you know, not having negative side effects? And then they raised the dosage as they established the safety of the procedure, but targeting this one malfunctioning gene. And by the end, they had given the highest dosage to 9 people. And again, as I said, the average improvement in people's sight was 100 times, but actually there were 2 people who had the highest dosage who had like a 10,000 times improvement in their eyesight. This is as measured by navigation and testing, sensing tests. So that's like the difference between needing like full midday sunshine to see versus being able to see like on a moonlit night, which is just such a huge difference. You know, again, it's a small study, but it's a huge, huge, huge difference to get from you know, this preliminary research.
That's very exciting. And of course, for those people, life-changing, absolutely life-changing.
Absolutely.
And it's great to see more of these gene therapies coming on stream, because the promise of it had been with us for so long, doing this program for 14 years, hearing about the first gene therapies and then just going, where are they? They're coming now. And it's very exciting what they can do. Susan, our third story has to do with COVID and its surprising effects on young girls.
Yes. So this work has been published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in the US, and it studied the rate of aging of brains of teenagers during the COVID pandemic. Now, this isn't the first study of this type, but it is the first to study the difference in the rate of aging of brains of boys and girls. So looking at the difference between the sexes. So the researchers who are based in Seattle, they used MRI machines to scan the brains of adolescents to look at the cortical thickness. That's essentially the sort of the thickness of the lining of the brain. So it's all over. And they studied to see the differences in the thickness of this area. This thickness basically is related to the age of the brain, and the thickness lining. So the lining of your brain gets thinner as you get older. That's quite normal. And so you'd see this thinning as you go through your adolescent years. But they analyzed the brains of girls and boys between the ages of 9 and 17 post-pandemic, and they measured this thickness of the cortical thickness. And it was compared to a baseline thickness that they had measurements of the same age cohort pre-pandemic. And their findings showed overall that there were 30 areas in girls' brains that were thinning in the post-pandemic cohort compared to the pre-pandemic cohort, and only two areas in the male brain that had this increased thinning. And then what they did was they calculated the age that this level of thinning would usually be seen at to get an idea of how kind of advanced this aging and this thinning was. And they saw that with girls, the brain was 4.2 years older than the normal kind of cohort. And for the male brains, it was 1.4 years. So it's a huge difference. So basically rapid aging of the brain based on, well, this is where the questions are. Is it, you know, what was it within the pandemic that created these changes? But it's the first, like a number of studies have seen this rapid aging, but none, this is the first that has demonstrated the difference between the male and the female cohorts. So it's fascinating stuff.
Is it easy to attach this to COVID? Is it very, like, does the data say this is COVID related, or could there have been something else going on?
Yeah, you know, there's so many studies of this type out there using these brain scans, and they're really quite robust. And so the question is, you know, what are the effects? There's specific parts of the brain in the girls that are basically related to social cognition where you saw this thinning. And then for the boys, it was a part of the brain that was used, or that's prevalent in processing objects in the field of view. So also processing faces. So like those connections, it's very hard for us at this stage to say, therefore, it's because of this. But we do know that there are changes. And of course, long-term effects and, you know, what that means for the social interaction of these, you know, these people as they get older, that still is all up in the air. But we do see that there is that different scene. And it's quite different between girls and boys. And it's nice to see that, because we often, it's become more and more important over the last 10, 15 years that we start to realize that there are differences in the sexes in terms of how they develop under certain diseases, etc. So this is a really nice study in that case.
Thank you very much. Our final story, Jessamine, has to do with syphilis, which is making a comeback.
I know. This is like things you wish never got a reboot. But unfortunately, syphilis is making a comeback. It is on the rise, both in Ireland and globally. And like, this is a disease that we know how to treat, but we actually need to get better at testing for it. So this is part of just a global rise in the rate of lots of sexually transmitted infections, including syphilis. And like, you know, syphilis might sound like it's an old-timey disease. That's because it comes from a bacteria. So it's very easily treated with antibiotics. Like in the 1990s, syphilis was almost completely eliminated in the US. And unfortunately, now we are looking at the highest rate since the 1950s. Cases have risen 80% in the U.S. in the last 5 years. In Ireland, we've had a 30% rise this year compared to last year. And the number of people being diagnosed with syphilis is just going up. Why this is a problem, even though we're very good at treating it, like if it's not caught quickly enough, it can cause huge issues. The syphilis bacterium is really, really aggressive. So it can attack your organs like the heart, bones. It can cross the blood-brain barrier and cause neurological issues. And it can also actually move through the placenta into the fetus, which can cause congenital syphilis, which is also pretty bad. It causes horrible issues, but like because it actually has so many mechanisms of action that can make it really hard to diagnose just based on symptoms. So the traditional testing for syphilis involves taking a blood sample and looking for an immune response. So this obviously has to be analyzed in like a blood testing lab, which can take days to weeks. It's really tricky in infants when you're looking at congenital syphilis because their immune systems are still developing. And like that time delay is actually a huge issue because as syphilis is coming back now, it's predominantly affecting marginalized communities who might not have regular access to healthcare. So having this delay in between taking, you know, a sample from somebody and then coming back and giving them a diagnosis is actually really problematic in terms of those people getting treated. So there's this new set of projects that's being funded by the National Institutes of Health in the US that's trying to look at, you know, can we take something like a cheek swab or a very small, easy sample from somebody and look on the spot for like proteins or DNA from the syphilis bacteria directly? So the goal here is just a small device that you could have in your doctor's office so that, you know, they like take a little swab, do a little test, and you get the results during your appointment and you can start treatment right then and there. That, you know, again, we know how to treat syphilis. We've known for a really long time, but making that diagnosis and the timeline just much faster is going to be critical to reducing the types of really negative effects that the disease can have on people.
Yeah. And if I cast my mind back, I mean, when you are young, free and single and you're
to what? To when you had syphilis, Jonathan. Careful.
If I did, it is just a disease and you shouldn't stigmatize me like that, Susan. But no, I don't think I've ever had syphilis. But what I did do is if you were having, having sex with partners, you know, you get yourself checked. That is really, really important because something like syphilis and lots of other things, we have a responsibility. If we're in the world doing this sort of thing to just make sure that we're doing it in a nice, clean and unsharing disease with everybody we sleep with way. Dr. Absolutely. Susan Kelleher from the DCU School of Chemical Sciences. I can talk to you about my private medical history later if you'd be really very interested. Dr. Jessamine Fairfield from the University of Galway. It is. Thanks so much for your time. Imagine you could read all of Genghis Khan's emails or check out Joan of Arc's Insta. Our internet has become unintentionally an enormous archive to the day-to-day interactions of everybody who ever lived in the time of digital data. But much of that archive is controlled by a handful of people. So what will future historians know about us? And what will happen to our data when we die? Well, Carl Oman is assistant professor in the Department of Government at Uppsala University in Sweden. He's author of The Afterlife of Data, What Happens to Your Information When You Die and Why You Should Care. He joins me now. Carl, why do you care? Why did you write this book?
I did write this book primarily, I must say, out of a philosophical interest. Most people have a kind of private or personal connection to the question of what happens to your data after you die. But one thing that I thought I could bring to the table as a sociologist and philosopher was the bigger questions. So if you would ask, like, somebody close to you dies and you ask, well, first of all, what do I do with the data? Where is it? Who owns it? How can I access it? All of these practically difficult questions, but also the morally difficult questions of what should I do with these digital remains, so to speak? I'm asking that type of questions, but not only for a single individual, but for an entire generation or a society.
Right now, what sort of data exists when someone dies? You're talking about emails and social media posts and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, of course. I mean, and these are the types of data that are the most visible to us. Obviously, like, we're aware of the stuff that we're leaving behind on social media, our emails. But there are also lots of invisible data, such as your search data. If you own an iPhone, you probably have the Apple Health app installed, which tracks every step that you're taking, literally. Every minute or so, your phone sends a geo data update on your whereabouts. And if you add those data onto a bigger network of other people's data, it actually tells you not only who you are, but also who the people around you are, such that, like, you know, in my whole household, we have four smartphones. And that geodata indicates that we are a family because you can see that these phones are constantly present to one another.
Huh. So you could potentially identify affairs.
Oh, yeah.
Or even potentially murders. By looking at geodata of two different people who have been together and mapping that stuff together. So lots and lots of personal data. When someone dies, does Google get a notification, or is it usually the deceased, a friend, family member, that then says, look, this person has died, can I access it? Is there a way of doing that in something like Google, Facebook, or Apple?
Yeah, I mean, when this first started happening, none of the big tech companies had the architecture in place to deal with death, because it's kind of like an afterthought. You gather a couple of hundreds of millions, maybe billions of people on your network, and then all of a sudden they start dying and you have no mechanism to take care of it.
What happens if I die on Facebook? Is there like a grave emoji on my... I'm not on Facebook anymore, but like if I die, does anyone know I'm dead?
Well, for a couple of years ago, the answer would have been no. Now they have a couple of features installed. One, someone close to you could actually submit a death certificate or like an obituary to Facebook to prove that you are in fact dead. And then they could have the option of either taking your profile down or turning it into a memorial site, such that people close to you could still post pictures and wish you a happy birthday in heaven and so on. And people do this. Like, you can actually see that activity on most profiles go up after they've died. after a couple of years, it wanes down. But in the first couple of years, people are very active in posting to the dead person, and they even address them. There are studies indicating that a majority of posts are addressing the dead person as if they can actually read what they're posting.
I'm sorry, you're telling me that rather than pointing their face up to the sky and saying, David, why did you leave me so early? I can't cope. They're doing this via Facebook messages or iMessage?
Yeah, you can even see like people are posting stuff like, oh, I'm so sorry, I was out hiking in the mountains yesterday and I had no service, so I couldn't congratulate you on your birthday, but... I'm now back at my laptop and I miss you so much, blah, blah. But and we kind of laugh at this now.
Not to laugh at other people's grief, but like that is so funny that you were like apologizing that the dead person was obviously on their Facebook page that day and it was like, what the hell happened, Martha? Like no birthday message? that's insane.
But it's funny because it follows a pattern that is as old as human civilization. Whenever there's a new communication technology, the first thing we use it for is to transcend whatever border separates the spirit world and the material world. If you see stone, for instance, like when we first started building things out of stone, the first things that we built were sepultures. Stone, like in most Neolithic cultures, building things out of stone was strictly reserved for the dead.
Wow.
And then when you see, when written language starts to emerge, it is in ancient Egypt, is one of my favorite examples, where it was thought that the dead could read your letters, but they couldn't hear you speak. So you would commonly write letters and leave them at the tombs of the dead such that they could write it or read it from the other side.
Wow.
And then if you fast forward to like photography, it's the very same thing. The first thing that we photograph are corpses. And then if you look at the telegraph, it's the same thing here. Yeah.
The first things we photographed were corpses?
Yep. For a long time. That was like the main use. People even staged corpses as if they're alive with like, you know, in everyday situations, like sitting at a table surrounded by their friends, but it's actually a corpse. So it was a way of preserving the memory of the dead.
Wow.
So it's from a historical point of view, it's not surprising that people are using the internet as a kind of way of transcending the spirit world, so to speak.
There's definitely some social media platforms I wish actually were reserved for the dead, but of course they're not. if I'm a wife, do I have access? Do I have legal access to my husband's Facebook messages and his emails and his all of his stuff?
No. No. No, you
not at all. Like, even if I'm married,
exactly. There may be some like if you have assets, like digital assets on various online deposits. Yes, sure.
Like what? Like like bank or like crypto?
Crypto, or let's say you would have some. It's maybe a far off example to some people, but like some people play video games and have avatars that may be worth lots of money. You could actually sell the avatars.
The NFTs, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
So that could happen, but like in terms of your private data, absolutely not. Like that, you sign an agreement as a user with Meta or X or whatever the network you're using is, that and that contract is between you and them, and they promise not to share your private information with anybody else.
Except people who want to sell you stuff.
for that purpose, yes.
So I guess a note to people who are listening, that if you trust and love someone implicitly and you've nothing to hide, so that's about four people, those four people should share their passwords with their spouses or loved ones in the case of going away. Because presumably there's things that people need to access, you know, digitally. That, you know, often we get emails about updates about assets or, you know, properties or, you know, whatever it is. I mean, I don't, but I presume people who are rich do. That information is obviously very useful to be able to look it up quickly rather than, you know, go through some filing cabinet. So having that password is an important thing to do for the people that you love.
Yeah, and you could like... Maybe you have, so Gmail, I think, has this developed this really cool service where it's called an inactive account manager. So if you're inactive on your account for a certain period of time, and you can choose that time yourself, then it will automatically send some of the content on your Google account to named recipients.
So oh, okay. Spend,
like, so like, I want this thing to go to that person and so on.
Oh, okay. That's pretty cool.
Facebook has a similar feature. They call it a legacy contact. So you can choose another Facebook user who's going to be like a steward of your profile should you die.
Let's talk a little bit about avatars, because now that you bring it up, I guess we are getting really, really close, right, to a level of technology. In fact, I think I'd say we have it. And right now, the level of technology where we can give an AI chatbot, train it on, I mean, God, there's so much I've done, like all my radio programs, all my Twitter. Yeah. If you took all that stuff, you would really be able to nail me to a T. We're at that stage, right? That, you know, are there companies who are currently taking the data of the dead and reconstituting that into a sort of digital zombie?
Yeah, there are several of them.
Anyone doing a good job of it?
They're doing like an okay job of it, I suppose. The thing is, the technology you need, which is basically a good large language model, only a couple of years ago, that was like science fiction.
Yeah.
And now most of us are using it every day. So whenever people ask me, like, is it possible to do it? I'm like, well, you know, just take a conversation log with someone that you have sent a couple of hundreds or thousands of messages back and forth with and feed that into ChatGPT-4 and just ask it to reproduce that personality. And it will do a decent job doing it. It actually happened only, is it like a year and a half ago now, where an app called Replica and their entire idea is that you train an AI to become like your best friend.
Yeah.
The initial idea was you train it to become you, but I suppose they thought users found that too creepy, so they rebranded and now they're like, oh, train your best friend. Okay, so of course what happened is that most people developed their quote-unquote best friend as a kind of best friend with benefits. So they're sexting with their AI and are developing like semi-romantic relationships with them.
Is that an urban myth, or have you actually spoken to people who have fallen in love with their AI girlfriend?
It's common.
Is it?
It's a big thing, but there's more. So Replica didn't like this. So just before Valentine's Day last year, they changed their algorithms so that your chatbot Replica wouldn't use any dirty words or sexting. And people were completely outraged. They're like, you killed my lover. You've like destroyed my relationship to my avatar and so on. So what they did was that they took the entire conversation log that they had with their Replica. They went on to ChatGPT-4, fed that into the model and said, reproduce this personality, but with the dirty words, so that it could actually resurrect a dead avatar based on them. So it's like, multiple levels of meta in the story. But I like it because it shows that this technology that was so distant only a couple of years ago, it now exists at anybody's fingertips, really.
Wow, that's bonkers.
Yeah.
What, I mean, like, there are potential good uses to that, though, right? I mean, if I was a kid struggling with history and I could speak to King Henry VIII and I could say, mm-hmm. why were you such a psychopath? And what have you got against women? And he would be able to try and defend himself in Old English. That would be awesome. That'd be great fun.
Yeah, I mean, as most powerful technologies, it both has big opportunities and dangers attached to it. Yes, of course, like the pedagogical opportunities are amazing. We can really make history come alive to children, but also to adults in actually forming a relationship to the past in a way that we haven't been able to before. And also thinking forward, thinking about the fact that not just kings and other powerful people, but actually anybody could leave an interactive legacy behind that can continue to interact with future generations. That being said, yes, that's really cool, amazing opportunities, but we mustn't forget that you're not actually interacting with Henry VIII. And there's a risk in that these models will give kids and future generations a false impression of their past.
Right.
Something that, of course, we
but as only as false as we completely understand Henry VIII. And in that case, it theoretically it could be as good as we could possibly get it. If you used all of the information we had about Henry VIII, it would be as close to as we would ever get. And if it was wrong, we wouldn't know because that's all we knew about Henry VIII, right?
Yes, but even so, these models and impersonations, they don't just arise from the data, but there are plenty of design choices as to, like, okay, let's say that you would have a conversation with Henry VIII. Okay, is he going to speak in the type of English that he actually spoke in? You would probably have trouble understanding what exactly he was saying. Most of the things that you would say to him, these concepts would probably be quite foreign to a person that lived hundreds of years ago.
Yeah.
So,
like, he probably hasn't heard it.
Somewhere a person would have needed to make a bunch of design choices as to, okay, so how do we adapt this information to actually turn it into an interactive agent that people can actually use and get some value out of?
Yeah, because, I mean, you could spend hours trying to, what do you think of Google? I have not heard of Google. What do you think of Facebook? I have not heard of Facebook. It could go on for quite some time. So you have to think about, you mean this search, this large library, and then it gets really corny. I could see the problems, in delivering that. I think that could really be bad. But something's just popped into my head, and that is Facebook at some point had billions of users. Is there going to be a point at which there's more ghosts on Facebook than people on Facebook? I mean, I don't mean bots, which of course there are already, but actual ghosts of people on Facebook. Would Facebook be more haunted than living?
Yeah. So this is a study I did in 2019 where we got hold of really good data. So a colleague of mine, David Watson, and I, we got hold of data from the UN where we had basically mortality predictions for each country each year of the 21st century and for each age group, crucially. Now, we could match that with data from Facebook on their age demographics for each country. And when you take those two data sets and put them together, you can actually build a pretty fine-grained model that predicts how many dead users are there going to be on Facebook a given year of the 21st century. Naturally, the answer depends on how is Facebook going to continue to grow over the course of the century. So we made one conservative model where Facebook more or less stops growing completely. And in that model, the crossover of the living and dead is going to be somewhere around the mid-2060s.
Right.
Which is pretty soon. But now in the other model, when Facebook continues to grow, the actual threshold is going to be far later, or at least in the beginning of the next century. But crucially, by the end of this century, they're going to have gathered close to 5 billion deceased profiles.
I'd be so amazed and really disappointed in the human race if Facebook is still around in more than 5 years, to be honest. But anyway, let's just finish very quickly, if you don't mind, Carl, with a solution. What do we do about all this? What do we need to do, societally or regulation wise?
Let me answer that question by bouncing off something you said about the future of Facebook. So the question I always get from journalists is, but how do you know Facebook is going to be around for another four decades? And my answer is, well, it's probably not, but that's what makes this question so interesting. What happens to all of those hundreds of millions of profiles if the company goes bust? Well, probably they're just going to be auctioned out to the highest bidder. And that is because we have no plan for the aging of the internet. We have no plan for the aging of the population of the internet. And we have no plan for the aging of the platforms that dominate the internet. So what we need to do, essentially, is to build some kind of infrastructure that lets the internet and its population age with dignity. Okay, that sounds very abstract. I understand that. But one of the things that we could do and that I really recommend is to institute some kind of online World Heritage label such that we would be able to preserve the data that is needed for future generations, but it wouldn't all be in the hands and the control of big tech.
Right. Okay. I mean, and you can probably extrapolate how that might work in the future, but I think there's a lot to figure out between now and then, so I wouldn't hold your breath. Carl Oman is the author of The Afterlife of Data, What Happens to Your Information When You Die and Why You Should Care. Carl, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Like, there's a lot of data, and like, there's a lot of my voice, right? People could get my voice exactly. It's slightly presentry.
A presentry version of you.
Like, am I right in saying that I sound pretty much the same in real life? Like, it's a slight difference, but it's not huge.
Yeah, there's a slight difference. It's more a presentation difference.
Yeah.
The voice doesn't sound different to my ear, which is normally, I find, the case with most of the hosts I've worked with, except for, interestingly, when you're out for like a drink with him, Pat Kenny, who like, you're out chatting to him and he's a perfectly lovely man and you're having a pint, but it sounds like you're in an interview.
Oh, really? Yeah. That's funny. Well, I guess he's sort of, the interview, the voice
so famous,
of interview.
Yeah.
Because I think you could do right now, you could do a really good imitation of me. And I don't know how I feel about that. Like, I'd love to be able to tinker with this. I'd love to make it better. add in a little bit of James O'Brien, take away a little bit of my foot and mouthiness. What about you? Like, would you be okay with people? Like, cause I kind of think for my kids, like if I died early, like for my kids to be able to kind of chat to me and it feel like I was there, like I'd be okay with that. I'm dead.
Yeah. I think the question on the other side was if you would want to chat to someone who you lost. I feel like that's not really very helpful.
Not helpful.
Well, I think it might help in the initial, part, but then like after you'd need to have a cutoff point at some stage.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I don't know. I mean, we say that now and people say, well, I need grief and closure. But we don't know what it's like to actually be able to have that conversation with someone. We don't have enough of an experimental body to be able to say if it's good. I mean, it feels like it should not be super healthy to talk to dead people.
Yeah. I think maybe I'm likening it to, so in particularly with a like romantic relationship, it's a time-honored tradition for people to, come back to their ex, even though it's over, and have discussions.
Both
parties know it's kind of not coming back.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, it's, yeah.
And that's,
not
I guess,
healthy.
The closest to it. It's not healthy.
Well, there's also, those mediums. Like, do you remember Derek Acora?
Yeah. Well, I don't
Hello. Michael, are you there, Michael? Michael, are you with us? You remember Derek Acora did a live, he tried to get Michael Jackson back, and he did a live TV show in which he claimed to channel Michael Jackson as a medium. And he was this big, long, he had this Liverpudlian accent. He was like, are you there, Michael? Absolutely brilliant television. I wonder where he is now. Not so much medium stuff going around anymore, is there?
No, there isn't, no.
Yeah. This could be the new medium thing, Like, I was just chatting with Michael Jackson. Yes. I mean, it could be cool.
Well, I did like your Henry VIII thing. Like, it would be good, like, whether or not there's any academic use to it, it would be good fun to be able to, like, talk to the various people from history and just be like, why were you such a shit? Yeah.
You could actually have a radio show. Welcome to,
History's Shits.
History's Bastards. This week we have Marquis de Sade. Marquis, what on earth happened to you? I spit on your grave, you piece of pumpkin shit.
Shit, we shouldn't have said that.
out loud
in the podcast. That's a top idea. And I don't mean this in a sarcastic way. I said it was a top idea earlier. This is a multi-million euro idea you've got.
We have no recordings of their voices, so we have to get someone. Like, I suppose Henry VIII has to be Brian Blessed, right? Has to be Brian Blessed. Yeah. Like, that's an obvious one. Right. Do you know what? You could workshop this. You could workshop. People could loan their voices for particular historical figures only.
Yeah.
And then forever, they would be the voice of Henry VIII. That'd be pretty cool. Right, time to look back at some of your comments from last week. As you heard, Aidan McKelvey has slunk into the studio to talk about what you wanted to talk about. So we've got a few texts in about mushrooms, and we can't really touch them, right? And I'll tell you why. It's because people talking about, oh, I did mushrooms for this and I did mushrooms for that, it kind of sounds like we're endorsing that. And while I am really not a judgy person in any way, I mean, that's genuinely true, right? At the same time, you can't go, oh, this person did that and that person did this, and then seem like you're kind of saying that's okay, because some people might say, well, you know, I heard it, and we could end up being inadvertently, you know, sort of pointed out as someone who sort of opened the door and said this is okay just by talking about it. Is that, am I wrong? Kind of, there's a position of influence, there's a responsibility. I'm talking this out with you in some way, Aidan, but actually it's kind of, I don't even need to talk it out. That's just the way it is, right?
Yeah, that is the way. And like,
yeah,
especially when it comes to, and if you have an illness or you're associating with an illness, like we would always end up saying on this show, and it is the way you should think, if you have an illness,
doctor,
go to your doctor, see what the doctor says. And maybe in the future, your doctor will be like, oh, I've got some psilocybin for you. But for the moment, that is untested or hasn't gone through the full process of testing. So go to your doctor, ask your doctor what they think is probably the best advice we can give you.
Indeed.
And what you do in your own time recreationally is none of our business.
None of our business. Yeah, none of our business indeed. But thank you for your comments and texts on those. We enjoyed reading them nonetheless. We do want your comments, and we will read them out, on what you would do with your data. Because we were talking about, you know, this afterlife data. Would you want family members to resurrect you digitally? Is there stuff in your emails that you would die if someone actually got to read? I know there probably is some in mine. There'd be some mortifying stuff would come out if people were able to read my emails after I died. But then I'd be dead. So does it matter? There's probably a fallout there somewhere. It's probably not good. Let us know. What do you think should happen to your data when you die? And do you care what happens to it? You can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can tweet us. We're @NewstalkScience. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey and Hugo da Silva on sound. We'll be back with more in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on Newstalk.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere, visit hyland.com.